The hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, we have a higher education story about legacy students at American universities. A discussion with Anna Mateo about the word board, and the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, this.
Scientists say they have successfully created embryo models designed to support research on early human development. The models are made from stem cells, simple cells in the body that can develop into one of many specialized cells. Researchers say the embryo models cannot grow into babies, but they are meant to be complete enough to provide information about what might be going on in the embryo during a pregnancy. The use of embryo models permits scientists to carry out research without the ethical concerns linked to experiments using real embryos. Several groups are working on the research. Teams from the United States and England shared their work in two studies that recently appeared in the publication Nature. Other scientists in Israel and China published studies on their work earlier this month. Those studies, however, have not yet been examined by a wider community of scientists. In-Soo Hyun is an ethicist and director of life sciences at Boston's Museum of Science. He is also a member of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. Hyun told the Associated Press that past research has centered on a process that creates pre-embryos designed to behave like real embryos. But the latest creations model an embryo after it has reached the uterus. Real human embryos can be extremely hard to see at that point in the process because they attach themselves deep into the uterus. The writers of several studies described models that look similar to human embryos 9 to 14 days after fertilization. Berna Sozin studies developmental stem cell biology at Yale University in Connecticut. She told the Associated Press, "If we can experimentally model this period, then we can finally start asking questions about how human development happens in those very early stages that are normally hidden within the body of the mother." Sozin added that scientists should be able to use the models to study embryonic failure, developmental disorders, and pregnancy loss. Another study was led by Magdalena Zernike-Gutz, an expert in stem cell biology at the California Institute of Technology and the University of Cambridge in England. The researchers say that model contains embryonic tissues and other tissues that can produce structures surrounding the embryo, such as the placenta and yolk material. The placenta is a structure that develops in pregnancy and attaches to the uterine wall. In the future, Zernike-Gutz said researchers could use human embryo models to explore the effects of the environment and chemicals on early human development. I'm Brian Lynn.
A civil rights group is taking legal action against legacy admissions at Harvard University. It says the practice discriminates against students of color by giving special consideration to mostly white children of alumni. The practice has faced growing criticism after the recent Supreme Court decision that ended the consideration of race in college admissions at Harvard and the University of North Carolina. The decision ended admissions policies used by American colleges to increase the number of Black, Hispanic, and other minority groups. The legal action was filed Monday by Lawyers for Civil Rights, a nonprofit group based in Boston. The group filed the complaint on behalf of Black and Latino community groups in New England. It argued that Harvard's admissions system violates the Civil Rights Act. Your family's last name and the size of your bank account are not a measure of merit and should have no bearing on the college admissions process, said Ivan Espinoza Madrigal. He is the group's executive director. The civil rights group National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, added its support to the effort on Monday. And the group asked more than 1,500 colleges and universities to make admissions more fair, including by ending legacy admissions. Opponents of legacy admissions say the practice is no longer defensible following the High Court's decision. They note that the Supreme Court's ruling says colleges must ignore the race of applicants, but schools can still give a lift to the children of alumni and donors. The complaint was submitted to the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. It uses Harvard data that became public during the affirmative action case that went before the Supreme Court. The records showed that 70% of Harvard's donor-related and legacy applicants are white. Being a legacy student makes an applicant about 6 times more likely to be admitted. The complaint points out that other selective schools, including Amherst College in Massachusetts and Johns Hopkins University of Maryland, have ended the practice. The complaint argues that Harvard's legacy preference has nothing to do with merit and takes away spots from qualified students of color. It asks the U.S. Education Department to declare the practice illegal. It also asks the department to force Harvard to stop the practice as long as the university receives federal funding. If legacy and donor preferences were removed, more students of color would be admitted to Harvard, the complaint says. Harvard said it would not comment on the complaint. The complaint was filed on behalf of CHECA Project, African Community Economic Development of New England, and the Greater Boston Latino Network. Also Monday, the NAACP started a campaign aimed to get universities across the nation to improve diversity. The group called on 532 public and 1,134 private colleges and universities to end legacy preferences, eliminate racially biased entrance exams, hire teachers from different backgrounds, and support poor and first-generation students. Another campaign is urging the alumni of 30 top colleges to stop giving donations until their schools end legacy admissions. That campaign, led by education nonprofit EdMobilizer, also targets Harvard and other Ivy League schools. U.S. President Joe Biden suggested last week that universities should rethink the practice. He said legacy admissions expand privilege instead of opportunity. It is unclear exactly which schools use legacy admissions and how much it helps. In California, state law requires schools to say if they use legacy admissions. The University of Southern California reported that 14% of last year's admitted students had family ties to alumni or donors. Stanford reported a similar rate. An Associated Press survey of the nation's most selective colleges last year found that legacy students in the freshman class ranged from 4% to 23%. At four schools, Notre Dame, the University of Southern California, Cornell, and Dartmouth, legacy students outnumbered black students. Supporters of legacy admissions say it builds an alumni community and can increase donations. The donations, they add, can help support poor students of color. I'm Dan Novak.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we discuss the word board. As a noun, board has a couple of meanings. It can be a long, thick piece of wood or other strong material, like a diving board. A board can also be a group of people who make decisions for an organization. An example is a board of directors. As a verb, board means several things. Board can mean providing food for someone regularly. For example, a college student's costs include housing and food, called room and board. Board can also mean closing off parts of a building with pieces of wood. Sometimes in scary movies, people board up the doors and windows to keep monsters from entering. Board, on board, and aboard are all used differently. At a train station, we sometimes hear a conductor say, "All aboard," as the train is getting ready to leave. And the captain of a ship might say, "Welcome aboard," as you climb on the boat. However, we say you board a plane, train, or boat when you get on it. And we say you are on board once you get on. If you agree with an idea or a process, we also say that you are on board with it. But we never say you are aboard with it. And if you are very excited about an idea or process, you do not just get on board, you jump on board. We also use the term onboarding to describe the process of starting a new job. This is the process in which new workers learn about a company, work rules, and things related to the job. At VOA Learning English and many other organizations, all workers are required to attend onboarding and other training. So we say the training requirement affects everyone across the board. We use the expression across the board when something affects every part or every individual within a larger group. For example, when the government raises taxes on all income levels, It affects everyone across the board. Experts say across the board comes from a horse racing bet. It means the same amount is bet for a horse to come in first, second, and third in a race. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. We hope you are on board with the expressions and use them in your next English conversation. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Thank you, Ana. I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Broadcast. We are joined now by Ana Mateo. Ana, you used the word bored a lot in this week's episode, but I was anything but bored listening. Nice job.
Thanks, Dan. And that was some good wordplay. We should let our listeners know that you use the word bored, spelled B-O-R-E-D, which means dull or tiresome, not interesting. But my story was about the word bored, spelled B-O-A-R-D. The words sound the same, but mean different things.
Ana, that's right. You didn't let me trick you. I listened to your story and I thought about all the times I used the word bored. Maybe one use you did not get into is the phrase above board. Can you tell our listeners about that? I, for one, like to be sure that all my business transactions are above board.
Dan, I thought about using that one, but I ran out of time. So this is a good time to tell our listeners about doing things the right way or keeping them above board. Some people think it has to do with playing card games and keeping your cards above board or on the table where other people can see them.
Ana, that makes sense. Sometimes when I play card games with my 6-year-old niece, I have to remind her to keep her cards on the table. No cheating. But next time, I'll be sure to say, keep your cards above board.
That's a good plan, Dan. You would be teaching her a new phrase, I'm sure.
Ana, at this point, she is so smart, she's the one teaching me new things, so for once, I'll be happy to go back to being the teacher like I was when she was a bit younger. You could say, I'm on board with that plan.
Aw, and Dan, at that rate, I'm sure she will be onboarding at her first job before you know it.
That's right. She is a smart cookie. I know she'll have a successful career. Well, thanks for jumping on board and helping me out today, Ana.
You're welcome, Dan. Anytime.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Rutherford B. Hayes. He took office in 1877 and was president during the end of what Americans call Reconstruction, the period following the Civil War. Hayes had a public image as an honest, dignified man, and even though he had ideas that were radical at the time, he supported moderate policies and measured change. One exception was alcoholic drinks. Hayes banned wine and liquor from the White House. Before Rutherford Hayes was born, his father died. Not too long after that, his older brother died too. As a result, Hayes grew up mostly with just his mother and his older sister. Later, an uncle helped raise him as well. As a boy, Rutherford Hayes was called Rudd. He grew up on a farm in Ohio and spent his early years playing with his sister, who taught him to love books. Hayes was an excellent student, and in time he attended Kenyon College and Harvard Law School. Hayes started his career as a lawyer in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio. He did not go into a field that made much money. Instead, he defended people who were poor or in difficult situations. He also courted the woman he would marry. Lucy Webb, like Hayes' mother and sister, strongly influenced the way Hayes thought. Hayes' own views at the time were moderate. He drank alcohol, but not much. He opposed slavery, but he was not an anti-slavery activist. His new wife, however, was strongly against alcohol and slavery. She was part of social movements at the time to ban alcoholic drinks entirely in the United States. And she encouraged Hayes to defend not only the poor in his law business, but also runaway slaves. Together, Rutherford and Lucy Hayes formed an equal marriage committed to helping others. They were known for being friendly, informal, and welcoming. They also went on to have 8 children, 5 of whom survived to adulthood. Lucy Webb Hayes said her husband was always calm as a father and took time, even when he was president, to care for his children. Because Hayes had such a positive public image, it is ironic that the contest that elected him president was one of the most hostile in U.S. history. The full story is complex, but the general story is that Hayes was the Republican candidate and Samuel Tilden was the Democratic candidate. Tilden won more popular votes across the country, but in the U.S. system, the majority of voters do not choose the president. Instead, a few electors in each state cast votes. In a way, then, the states choose the president. And in the election of 1876, 3 southern states gave conflicting reports. It was not clear whether Tilden or Hayes had won South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. Even though the election was held in November, the debate over the winner lasted until the following March, days before the new president was to be sworn in. One of the most serious accusations was that Democrats in the South had prevented many black men from voting. If those men had been able to vote, they almost certainly would have voted for Hayes. In the end, a special commission in Congress gave the votes in all 3 disputed states to Rutherford Hayes. His opponents pointed out that the majority of people on the commission were Republicans. As a result, they said, the new president had earned his position only because of party politics. They called him Rutherfraud and his fraudulency. But in the end, Hayes was widely considered an independent president who operated outside of party loyalties. One of Hayes' first acts as president was probably his most important. He withdrew federal troops from southern states. The troops had been trying to protect the civil and political rights of African Americans. But white Democrats disliked the federal government's involvement in their affairs. Also, the troops were not very effective. So Hayes said, if Southern officials promised to obey the country's laws, protecting all people equally, he would end the federal government's occupation of their states. The officials agreed, and the period known as Reconstruction officially ended. But as the years went on, the rights of Black Americans were increasingly violated. As a result, part of Hayes' legacy is one of betrayal. His policy permitted systemic violence and racism to continue for decades. Another of his important acts was to reform the country's civil service. For the most part, members of Congress offered their political allies government jobs with good pay. But Hayes sought to change the rules. He wanted to give government jobs to the most able workers. While his goal was a good one, his action shocked and angered many members of Congress. The Democrats especially sought to weaken Hayes' position by removing the president's ability to veto their bills. Hayes fought back and won. By the second half of his term, Hayes had restored some of Americans' trust in government that had been lost under the two presidents before him, Andrew Johnson and Ulysses S. Grant. He had helped ease the tensions between the North and South. He had stabilized the economy. He had increased the power of the presidency in a mostly positive way, and he had prepared the way for major civil service reform. But Hayes is not remembered as an especially great president. He is often placed toward the middle, not one of the best and not one of the worst. Some historians suggest that Hayes would be better remembered if he had stayed a second term and supervised some of the gains begun in his first years. But Hayes had promised that he would serve only one term as president. So, true to his word, Hayes did not seek re-election. Hayes had always believed that the best way to solve the country's problems was to improve the education system. So, in his retirement, Hayes became president of two social welfare organizations. One aimed to provide a Christian education to blacks in the South. One of the people helped by that organization was the well-known writer and activist W.E.B. Du Bois. Hayes also led a group aimed at reforming the country's prison system. When he was 70 years old, Hayes fell ill. Although he had a big heart for children and for helping people, he died of heart failure. Afterwards, one of his sons began a new tradition in honor of his father. He established the first presidential library. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.